Ladies and gentlemen, the Theosophical Society has much pleasure in presenting Mr. Geoffrey Hodson, international lecturer and author, in a talk entitled, How the Human Soul Descends to Birth.
Friends, our subject is of very great importance at this time in human history. For, unfortunately, the present is a materialistic age in which attention tends chiefly to be devoted to mundane things and spiritual verities tend to be ignored. This is a profound error, as the state of the world today indicates, for the material cannot be understood apart from the spiritual. There are three factors, amongst others, which contribute to the adoption of a materialistic view of life. And they are the existence and operation of our ordinary formal minds. These, until illumined by intuition, tend to be objective, mundane, as also argumentative, prideful, and acquisitive. And these attitudes of mind have the effect of shutting out spiritual illumination and intuitive perceptions. There again, spiritual principles are not self-evident. Man lives in a world of obvious material phenomena, and normally these constitute the total impact of the universe upon man's senses and upon his mind. All too often, it is only when things begin to go wrong that man seeks, below the surface of the obvious, for possible causes and remedies and some spiritual understanding. Unfortunately, however, information concerning the spiritual aspect of nature and of man is so often advanced to us by religious orthodoxy in incomprehensible and unconvincing forms. The mind is inclined to be repelled by an appeal to blind faith alone, when what we really need is intelligent comprehension. And this, I suggest, is part of the human tragedy of today. For a spiritual understanding of life is both a basic human need and an essential to intelligent and harmonious and therefore happy human living. Fortunately, the required knowledge has always existed and been available. It is, in a word, theosophy. And it is theosophy, meaning the divine wisdom, which I am going to draw upon in this address in offering certain ideas concerning love, marriage, parenthood, in both their happy and their unhappy conditions. As soon as our minds are turned to these subjects, at least seven questions present themselves. What are these? Well, surely we want some deeper knowledge as to how the experience of true love arises. Why is it so selective, causing us to feel drawn especially to this or that individual and not so closely to many others? Why also, for some people, is love fulfilled in happiness, whilst for others, love ties are withheld, denied, or if they are granted, they later are tragically broken? from these questions we would like to know, what is the highest ideal in the love relationship, especially one which will cause it to endure? Then, with regard to parenthood, whence comes the child who is born to us? And when does the soul enter the body, and by what means? Is it at birth? Is it at conception, or somewhere during the prenatal period? And finally, if time permits, we will glance at least at the ideal form of child training at home and at school, or at least the ideal attitude towards these procedures. In the light of theosophy, these several questions can indeed be answered in terms of reason and justice. I have decided, therefore, to begin my answer to them by repeating certain ideas which are applicable to those aspects of human life. For example, we must begin by a certain knowledge of man himself. What is the theosophical view of the real nature of man? What are we, you and I? Are we just this named personality with the differences of race and outlook and perhaps color of complexion and sex? Or is there something more? Theosophy says yes, far more. For man is an evolving spiritual being, ever seeking fuller, freer self-expression. He is indeed a pilgrim God, an evolving spiritual being. The true self of man is the spiritual power, life, and consciousness for which the body is a vehicle only. The body is not the self, which is distinct from the body and the bodily life. Now here, at once, much light is thrown upon the questions which I put forward just now. For love, for example, which is bodily alone, is not complete and is not likely to bring lasting happiness. It will endure only as it deepens to include mental and spiritual communion and unity. Such love is selfless and even, if necessary, sacrificial. It includes a deep concern for the spiritual as well as the physical welfare of the beloved. And some philosophers think that this kind of love alone is truly worthy of the name. This is indeed the ideal relationship between those who love, and such an attitude of deep solicitude for the spiritual welfare and progress of the beloved is the most certain assurance of happiness. Unfortunately, neglect of this point of view and approach is a prevalent source of frustration and failure. Furthermore, the receipt of another's deep affection always brings with it a great responsibility. They have placed their lives and themselves in one's hands, and the remainder of that life, and even lives which follow, can be a success or a failure according to the treatment meted out to those who honor one by giving one their love. So, in all human companionships, the ideal is to draw out and encourage the very highest and best in those with whom one is thus associated. A successful marriage or comradeship from this spiritual and theosophical point of view, A successful marriage is one which recognizes both the whole nature of man and his goal of perfection, and also aids both partners to advance along the path which leads to perfection. Indeed, the ideal in all human relationships is helpfulness, not only physically though, but intellectually, culturally, and spiritually as well. Theosophy gives us a clue to this kind of fulfillment of the love relationship, for it points out with world religions that the goal of man's existence is perfected manhood. And the parents help greatly, for they provide the body by which the spiritual soul of their child enters upon a new phase of life's journey. The environment, the training, must be such that the inherent powers of the spiritual self reach their fullest and finest expression. Parents also, therefore, should feel the same deep concern for the spiritual welfare and progress of their children as ideally they should feel for each other. The absence of this attitude causes that parental neglect which so often is at the root of youthful errors and delinquency, as I may show a little later on in greater fullness. Now, this goal of human perfection is said to be attained as a result of response to the experiences of many lives on earth, or by reincarnation, briefly stated. Each new life, now we are concerned, remember, with the parental attitude towards the child, more especially. For that child, each new life is not really a beginning of physical experience. Rather, is it a continuance, being but one in a series of lives, all strung together like pearls on a golden thread. For the bodily self, consciousness is continually broken by sleep and death, but the inner self neither sleeps nor dies, its consciousness being continuous. And so it is fully aware of all the experiences of former lives and harvests the fruit of them. And now, as the new body is born, enters into a continuance of the preceding unbroken experiences. Now, this is strange selectivity in love. The apparently extraordinary choices of the awakening of deep love. How do they arise? Well, again, Theosophy answers, from close associations in former lives, though, of course, admittedly, biological attraction also plays its natural and rightful part. But karma, or action and reaction, links not only the successive lives of people, but also of groups of people, such as nations, fellow citizens, families, and also those who love. Also, the operation of the law of cause and effect, particularly one's preceding conduct, decides both the nature and the outworkings of all human relationships. Nowhere, says Theosophy, is there chance. Everywhere the operation of law, which is also man's teacher, as well as his assurance of complete justice. So, the selectivity The feeling of being drawn to one person rather than another, when it is deep and true and lasting, is in all probability based upon the fact that there have been friends or lovers in various relationships in preceding lives, and they are now drawn to each other by a kind of instinctual as well as spiritual memory of previous love relationships. Rather a beautiful idea, don't you think? Plato, the Greek philosopher, wrote an amusing dialogue about love. He said, and of course he was writing allegorically only, he said that in the beginning man was not as he is now, a being with two hands, two legs and one face. No, he was spherical and very powerful. He could see, for example, in every direction, and he could roll anywhere with inconceivable speed. He was mighty, said Plato, because he was complete. The gods on Olympus grew afraid of this creature of power and freedom, and so they decided that they would cut him in two. Then they sliced him down the middle, and these two halves moved apart. And ever since, they've been searching for each other. They've been seeking that completeness, unity, and perfect wholeness, which was their original state. That search and that finding of the other half, said Plato, is the impulse towards and the experience of love. It is only an allegory, of course, but there is much truth in this view, but not the whole truth, I think. The inner immortal self of man is indeed a whole being. It exists in wholeness, completeness, and it contains the potentiality of male, female, and androgyne. But of course, here in the outer mortal personality, there is incompleteness. Here there's male and female distinct from each other. And this has been brought about by nature's processes of incarnating the total spiritual self into a partial manifestation as man or woman, with the accentuation and predominance of one or the other polarity. In this sense alone, at birth, the ego may be said to be cut in two, the gods on Olympus being personifications of the irresistible evolutionary forces in nature. The oppositeness of masculine and feminine is indeed part of the cause of purely physical attraction, but theosophy teaches deep love is also a renewal of a preceding bond from a former life, as I have been saying. True, new links are continually being formed, but lasting love, deep love, nearly always is a renewal of love relationships from former lives. Perhaps, as I say that, you might ask, what then of the celibate state, whether it's self-chosen or enforced by circumstances? Well, here two principles amongst others may be more especially in operation. One is that loved ones from former lives with the particularly close association may either be out of incarnation or born in parts of the world and under conditions in which a reunion does not occur, or if it does, is not fulfilled. The other principle is that the evolution of the spiritual self of man is subject to guidance under law by intelligences, superhuman or archangelic. And under that guidance it is seen that the unmarried state may be regarded by them as especially beneficial to the evolution of the inner self for the particular incarnation concerned. And so, after due consultation with the reincarnating self, circumstances tending towards celibacy may be deliberately arranged, but always remember, without infringing that freedom of action within the law of cause and effect, which is ever accorded to man at all levels of his existence. Lest this evolutionary aid and the possible loneliness and frustration which it produces should prove to be unduly hurtful to the person concerned, perhaps I should make it clear that such celibacy could be for one life alone, and that love, marriage, and parenthood, if desired, will certainly be experienced in future lives as they have been in the past. For these are also of very great value in the progress and education of the reincarnating self. Nevertheless, many people, men and women, do not marry. And there is the possibility of retreat, monasticism, or conventualism. These may, in their turn, take such strong holds upon people that they tend to continue them for several successive lives. In this case also, evolutionary pressure and guiding intelligences will almost certainly prevent the too prolonged continuance of the habit. The law of cause and effect and the thrust of spirit forward in unfoldment and evolution will in due course operate to bring about a return to a more normal kind of human existence. And that brings us to the problem of the fulfillment or frustration in love, marriage, and parenthood of those who engage in them. This also, fulfillment or frustration in love, marriage, and parenthood, is entirely governed by the law of cause and effect. Sometimes the causative attitudes of mind, emotions, and physical conduct existed in the present life, mistakes having been made, or they may have been set going in preceding incarnations. Thus, theosophy throws a great light upon the universal human problem of finding enduring happiness and harmony, or their opposites, in companionship, in love, and marriage. We might perhaps express the solution in terms of a simple postulate, something like this: selfishness, harshness, and disloyalty in love inevitably bring to those who manifest them the same types of experience in later lives. Similarly, unselfishness, kindness, and loyalty in love are reaped again by those who have sown them in former lives. All you see occurring under the law. Now, parenthood and the children who come to those who provide bodies for them. Where do they come from, and how do they fit into this picture of links formed in former lives and fulfilled in happiness or frustrated in sorrow as a result of conduct which invokes the operation of the law. Well, concerning parenthood, the spiritual selves, when reincarnating, tend quite frequently to be drawn to those families with whom they have affinities from former lives. In this case also, relationship in general and degrees of understanding and affection are direct products of preceding associations. However, parents will do well always to remember that the body of the newborn child alone is new, infantile, born of material parentage. Only the body is a baby, a newborn child, whilst the indwelling self, the divine visitor in the little baby body, that is an eternal, imperishable being, born of God himself. A divine visitor indeed. This brings me to our next question, the procedure of reincarnation, the entry of the inner self into its new physical bodies, as also those of mind and emotion as well. Theosophy enables its students to approach this subject from a unique point of view, to look at it as it were from the level of the reincarnating self, rather than from below, from the bodily situation. Let us then imagine that, endowed with the necessary spiritual perceptions, we are in the presence of such an ego who, according to the great rhythms of life, cosmic and human, is once more about to embark upon the experience of human life in a body on earth, is going to be born as a baby again. What shall we find? Remember, the inner self of man is always in a state of happiness, bliss. But at this time, there may well be an added expectancy of all the fruitage to be gained from the new experience to be entered into again. Then the egos or spiritual selves of the father and the mother-to-be may most probably be drawn into close association, all three happy, especially at a new link being formed, a close and intimate association going to be entered into. Then within the inner self there will be held certain ideals, plans for further development, and in reasonably advanced souls a sense of a mission to be fulfilled, a work to be done, a mode of life to be followed. Fortunately are those reincarnating egos who, as a result of life's experiences and parental and educative experiences, are able to fulfill that ideal held even before birth. They will have an especial happiness, the one expressed so truly in the proverb, "Happy is the man who has found his work." This means that the individual person down here is really fulfilling the inner spiritual purpose for coming into incarnation. Then what happens? Well, the inner self naturally projects its attention, its power, its life, and its consciousness towards the material world. In the process, vehicles begin to be built of mental matter and of emotional matter. These will be instruments of thought and feeling. And then at the moment of conception, the egoic projected ray of consciousness and life is linked especially to that first twin cell. Then the inner self is actually connected with the physical world and the first beginnings of its new physical body. Thereafter, as the science of embryology teaches, whether physical or superphysical, the procedures of gestation and growth continue for the 9 months of prenatal life. Thereafter, eventually, the new baby body is born and the new life, separate from the protection of the maternal body, begins, and as Masefield puts it, the old soul takes the road again. Now let me sum up some of the ideas which I've ventured to put before you, drawn, according to my understanding, from Theosophy. Love, marriage, and comradeship provide unique opportunities for the fullest and highest self-expression, for mutual service, and for spiritual and cultural unfoldment. And this indeed is their true purpose, and constitutes a great part of their beauty and of their value to the evolving spiritual self. Marriage, then, and parenthood can prove to be valuable forms of education and progress, not only in the technique of the conduct of human life and relationships, but also in the development of desirable aspects of human character. To neglect, to ignore, and even scorn this spiritual factor in human relationships is to court disaster. That kind of living, which is based upon sheer materiality and bodily life alone, can never bring fulfillment. There must be an understanding, acceptance, and application of spiritual values and purposes as well. And when these are combined in true love, then happiness and fulfillment will be the result.